We started a series of looking at the Ten Commandments. So let's try tonight to look at the idea of Shabbat, right? Which is the... Try to understand why it's fundamental. We try to set up, if you remember, the concept of why there are Ten Commandments, why they're different or unique, why they need to be ten, the order in which they go, the parallels between the first five and the second five. As we work through the series, we'll try to understand some of these ideas. But let's just extract one of them and use that as a starting point. We said that the Ten Commandments are not more basic or fundamental in philosophical terms, necessarily, than other things in Torah, but they are the categories that contain the rest, right? That's what's unique about these ten. That all 613 mitzvahs, commandments, are folded, they unfold, if you like, from these ten. These are the root categories. When Moshe Rabbeinu came down from the mountain holding the ten commandments, it wasn't sort of a sample. You know, he couldn't carry them all, so he chose ten, you know. Or the concept that these are more sort of more weighty in some way. I'm not sure about that. I don't know why not coveting, or bearing false testimony against somebody in a court case, is that worse than, taking interest or false weights and measures, you know, in business dealings or... many other things that the Torah prohibits or commands that are very weighty. I'm not sure that each one of the Ten Commandments necessarily fits that concept. Rather, what they do is they are root categories which, if developed correctly, will manifest all of the mitzvahs among them. If you knew how, you can derive each of the mitzvahs of the Torah from these ten. We try to show that in the sense of the first commandment, for example, obviously containing all of them, which is not difficult to see. The first commandment, which is relate to me, I am Hashem. Obviously, every commandment in the Torah is a fulfillment of that mitzvah as well. The second, which is have you shall have no gods before me, the problem of idolatry, which we spoke about previously, that is the root of all negative commandments. Anytime you break any, you transgress any law in the Torah, you're also, as it were, worshipping a false god. You're going away from Hashem and disloyalty. So that is the root of all negative commandments. And you can think of this theme through and see how each of these ten categories is a root of a set of others. And among the whole set of ten, you include the whole Torah. Why is the observance of Shabbat fundamental? Right? Let's just understand that. You know that there are many ways to say this. It's conventional that a person who is religious, what in English they call religious, we call a Shomer Shabbat, someone who keeps Shabbos, right? Why? Why is that the appropriate term to describe somebody who is observant? I could say somebody who eats only kosher food. I don't know, a believer, I would say. Somebody who is loyal to God. I mean, there are a lot of ways you could talk about an observant person. Why do you say the person is a Shomer Shabbat, the person observes Shabbos? Why is that, right? Why is that fundamental? Why is the observance of Shabbos so fundamental in its enormity? That means that the depth of its obligation, the enormous punishments or damage, let's say, spiritual damage for breaking Shabbat. Right? Why? Why is it so fundamental? What is the meaning of Shabbat? You know, the way you keep Shabbos is by not doing creative activities. What does that mean? Let's just be clear about this. You know that in the non-Jewish world, the notion of the Sabbath is that you have to rest. The rest. Can't work hard. There's complete misunderstanding from a Torah point of view, right? There's no prohibition of actually exerting yourself on Shabbos. Right? What you're not allowed to do on Shabbat is strike a match, write two letters, stitch two stitches. Right? We're talking about very little exertion. We're talking about creative activity. There's no direct prohibition on forced labor. Let's say you've got the kind of wife who makes you carry the furniture around on Shabbos, rearranging it, you know, until you've got double hernias and you're collapsing of exhaustion. That's okay. That's fine. I mean, it might be a marital, you know, issue, and it may not be in the spirit of Shabbos, but there's no direct transgression of Shabbat. Shabbos is not the non-Jewish concept. The Christian concept is that it's a day of rest. It's not a day of rest. You're not required. Yes, it's true that you shouldn't exert yourself in a way that's not dignified on Shabbos. Because Shabbat is like a temple in time. So you shouldn't run unnecessarily unless it's running for a mitzvah. Some people are very careful to speak in a special way on Shabbat. I knew great rabbis who would only speak Hebrew on Shabbos. A special day. You have special law to have special clothes on Shabbat. Just like you wouldn't walk into the temple dressed in casually, you dress specially, you have special suit of clothes for Shabbos. But, and therefore to get sweaty and exert yourself in a way that's not dignified, possibly is not in the keeping with the spirit of Shabbos. But it's not prohibited. And yet what's prohibited is very small activities, carrying a small object from your house into the public domain, right? Or cooking, or dyeing something, a color, right? Or making something new, putting laces into new shoes. What's the big deal? You can't put laces into new shoes on Shabbat. You're making the shoes. You can put laces into old shoes on Shabbat, because you're not making the shoes, right? You're just relacing them. But if you do something that is creating something new, you buy a new suit. On Shabbat, you realize you never took the stitching out of the... You know, sometimes suits have, like, stitching in the pockets. Yes? No? You pull those threads out. You can't do that on Shabbat, because now you've made the suit usable. That's called... That's the last step. The final act, right, which makes an object complete. There are 39 of these categories. Selecting, for example. Selecting. You got peanuts and raisins, right? You don't like the raisins. So you start picking out the raisins. You're not allowed to do that. Total transgression. You can pick out the peanuts. You can take what you want, but you can't select out what you don't want. Selecting. You get a piece of fish on Shabbos, right? You can eat the fish off the bone. You can't take the bone out of the fish. What's the big deal? What would? First of all, whatever the big deal is, you see it's got nothing to do with work. It's not a concept of exertion. It's a concept of controlling creative activity. These are the 39 categories that were used to build the world. According to the deep understanding, the way it works is that these 39 categories are creative activities. In fact, a qualification of each of these categories is it has to build something in the world. Right? For example, on Shabbos, you may not erase, or you may not demolish. Let's say demolish a building. But you're only prohibited if you're demolishing to build. Is that clear? Let's say you're going to break down a building on Shabbat. So it's not prohibited if you break it down. The Torah, I'm talking about not rabbinically, I'm talking about from a Torah point of view. You're only prohibited from breaking down a building if you're preparing the site for a new building. Because then it's constructive. Or you have some writing and you're erasing it to have clear paper on which to write again. That's prohibited. It has to be a constructive activity, not a destructive activity. Extinguishing a fire, for example, on Shabbos, is only prohibited if you're trying to make charcoal. You're trying to get something out of the extinguishing. You're not just destroying something or negating something. These are the same 39 categories that Hashem used to create the world. In a very deep Kabbalistic sense, when he created the world, these were the activities in physics or chemistry that were used to create the world. The microcosm of the world is the Mishkan. The sanctuary in the desert was built with exactly these 39 activities. They needed to dye colors in materials. They needed to cut things to size. Stitching was involved. Writing was involved. Right? There were 39 creative activities done to build the Mishkan, the original version of the temple, if you like, the Mishkan. And what we do on Shabbos is we are not to do the 39 things that were done. The weekday is for creating the world, and Shabbos is for desisting from creation. If you like, the weekday is for becoming, and Shabbos is for being. During the week you develop, you build new. On Shabbat you simply consolidate and deepen and enrich what it is that you are. There's even an idea that on Shabbat you should not learn new material. You should revise what you learned during the week. Why? The week is for developing and building. Shabbat is for bringing it home. Consolidation. That's why it's a special family time, a special marriage time. It's a time of consolidation and bringing home where the essence of what's become in the week seeps into the depth of what you are. There are many mysteries with Shabbos. The word Shabbat means to sit down. The word Shabbat means to stop. It means to sit. It means to return. Shav in Hebrew means to go back. Teshuvah, which means repentance, self-correction, going back to the pure version of your own self before you made mistakes in the world. The word Shabbat and Tashuv are the same letters. What is all this about? What is Shabbat going back to? Why is it a sitting down? Shvu ish tachtav. Each person should sit where he is. On Shabbos, you can't walk. You can't go out of the city limits. You can't go a certain distance, travel on Shabbat, right? It's a place It's a contraction into the self and living in the spiritual world. Let's try to understand a little bit about this incredible idea. And I'd like to try to convince you that it's very hard to think of anything more important. Very hard to think of anything more important than this idea. The wrong way to understand it is a day of rest. The right way to understand it is a day of final destination. Right? Let's try to understand this amazing idea. If there's time, we try to talk about the extra soul of Shabbos. On Shabbat, a person gets an extra soul. What does that mean? Let's begin to try to unravel this concept and why it's so central. I would say that if there's one theme that one should use to understand Shabbos, it is that it's a focus of destination. I would say it like this. Every journey is meaningful only if it has a destination. A journey has meaning is defined by its destination. Journeys are named for their destination, right? When you go someplace, you know, you're taking the Gateshead train, the Newcastle train. What does it mean? Where you're going, not where you're getting the train. You need to know where you're going to get on the train, I suppose, otherwise you won't get on it. But that's not the point. The point is the destination, right? A journey is meaningful. When you're on a journey, every detail of the journey has meaning only because of the destination. How much it cost you, the ticket. It's worth it because you need to get that destination, right? Even the luxury of the journey, whether you go first class or not, okay, is only justified if the journey is justified. Actually, if a person's insistent on traveling in luxury, it could be that their destination is the journey. There's a destination like that too. There's people who travel because they enjoy traveling. So the journey is their destination. It could be. But every process has an endpoint. Every journey has a destination. The process of the week has a destination, and that's called Shabbat. Why is this important? Because the concept of Shabbat teaches you that everything you're doing in life must be defined by an endpoint where that thing comes to fruition or goes home, if you like, completes its cycle, reaches its perfection. You know, all the important ideas in Judaism we practice once a year. Once a year. Pesach, freedom, very important, but once a year is enough. Receiving the Torah itself, very important, once a year is enough, Shavuot. Rosh Hashanah, personal judgment, incredibly important, once a year, Yom Kippur. Shabbos is so important, you have to do it every week. Why? Because there's one thing you can never forget on a journey, and that's your destination. Every detail of the journey, every single step has to be towards destination. If you're going on a journey, you take a step out of the direction where you're traveling in. That's ridiculous. Every step has to be towards a destination. Shabbos is a reminder that there's an ultimate destination. A person who's traveling with no destination, that means a process is taking place and it doesn't lead any place. The process is ridiculous. You go to a famous inventor's lab and you walk into this very complicated lab, and on his desk he's got this incredible looking machine. So you ask him what he does and he says, "This is the most brilliant machine ever invented." Tell him, "Well, yeah, it looks amazing. What does it do?" He says, "When you switch this machine on, it runs itself. It diagnoses its own faults and it fixes itself. It oils itself. It fuels itself. It keeps itself going. It keeps itself clean. This machine is completely independent. It runs forever by itself." And you say, "That is amazing. And what does it do?" He said, no, you don't understand. It keeps itself going. It oils itself. It fuels itself." And you say, "Yeah, but what does it produce?" He says, no. The man is an idiot. He's a brilliant idiot, but he's an idiot. If the machine does all that stuff and makes you a pizza, or boils you a cup of coffee, or makes something useful, then it's an incredible machine. But a machine that does nothing other than the machine is ridiculous. Most people on earth keep going just to keep going. Most people on earth don't have a destination. Most people on earth go to work to earn enough money to survive so that they can go to work the next day so they can earn enough money to go to work the next day so that what? So they can collapse unconscious at the weekend to have enough strength to go to work the next week, to have enough money to go to work the next week. So they can eventually have enough money to collapse unconscious on the beach at the end of the year, totally comatose, so that they can do that again for the next year. Why? So in the back of their heads, they've got the idea that if they do this enough, they'll eventually have enough to do what they want to do. But by the time they get there, the arthritis is going to be so bad, they won't be able to chase what they thought they'd be chasing. You know, it's just... Most people on earth, unfortunately, keep going just to keep going. That is an ultimate tragedy. The point of being here is to keep going so that you can do something useful. If there's no end point, if the point of the journey is just to keep journeying, there could be nothing sadder than that. Shabbos is here to teach you that the journey ends in a destination. The best way you can say it is like this. Our concept of life is that it's a journey. And the journey is meaningful because it's a destination. The destination of this world is called the Messianic Age and the world to come. The destination of a personal, private, individual life is what you will be when you leave this place. When you go to a dimension in which time doesn't pass, or rather time passes but never dies. That means when you leave this world, or this life, or this body, after all the incarnations without getting into that, and you finally reach a final destination, or a final situation, it's not a static destination, but a final situation. Our concept, the Jewish concept, is that that final destination is nothing other than what you have become. You know what a destination is? It's when you walk all the steps of the journey, you finally get to a place that is the destination. What is that? It's all the steps you walked. If you didn't take another step, you aren't dead. The journey, the meaning of the destination is where all the steps took you. If you took those steps, that's where you are. If you never took that step, you aren't there. The Jewish concept, the Torah concept, is that the next world is only what you have become. That's the destination. And there's nothing more important than that. Self-correction refining your character and learning a lot of Torah, that's all fine if you're becoming something. But the fact, all of those are parts of a construction that is the developed self. And that's eternal. Yeah? That's forever. The Jewish vision of the world to come is that all you experience there is what you are and what you could have been. That's all. Many of our descriptions of the world to come are descriptions of a person seeing very, very clearly what they are, with no facade, stripped naked of all the illusions and the facade and all the ego. And all you experience, all you're faced with, this intrinsic inner being that you have become, is a vision of what you could have been. How much of what you could have become, you've become, is your ecstasy. How much you could have become that you didn't become is terrible pain. Of course, ultimately that pain is a correction as well. That's why some Talmudic sources say that in the next world, the person is not compared. Some of the Kabbalistic sources say that in the next world, you are utterly alone. There are different angles on this, but one of the dimensions of description of the next world is that you're completely alone. Why? Because there's no point in being shown someone else. You're not being compared to anybody else. That wasn't your job. You're not compared to somebody else. You're compared to what you could have been. Yes, it's true that husband and wife are eternally bonded into each other. As I said before, that's good news for some of us and a little distressing for others. But be that as it may, that's only because husband and wife are really two halves of one being. But what you are is... that's when you're ultimately compared to what you could have been. Right? The challenge of life is to become what you could be. Most of us don't even begin to realize 1% of what it is. Don't even begin to realize what it is, let alone to start becoming what it is that we could be. But that's what life is for. And therefore, the next world, the concept of the next world is having reached a situation that is, right? One of the meanings of schar mitzvah, that the reward of a mitzvah is a mitzvah. Meaning, the reward of a mitzvah is what it's constructed. And in the next world, that construction is what you have. That's your, nothing more delicious than something you built yourself. If there's one message in life that you can't afford to forget, it's that. You can't afford to forget that every activity you're doing is translated into eternity. Every breath, every conversation, every smile, every act of self-control, every act of giving is something that's being translated into the eternal, intrinsic existence of what you are. And therefore, Shabbos is a constant reminder that this journey ends. What's the quality of the next world? When you get there, you are what you have become. The upside of the next world is the ecstasy of having developed. The pain of it is no more chance to develop. There's no more vessel. Without a body, you can't act. Without ability to act, you can't manifest, you can't develop. And therefore, it's a frozen situation. The purpose of life is getting to create the kind of person you're going to feel comfortable with for eternity. Not the kind of person that you're actually not going to like very much. And therefore, the quality of this world is that it's a world of walking. When a person reaches the next world, it's a quality of sitting. Yes, it's a journey that is undertaken, but not by your own. You know, when someone dies, we sit on the floor. We sit down. Why? Because we sit in empathy for the situation of a soul that can no longer walk. Jewish life is called walking. Jewish law is called halakha. Halakha means walking. Right? In the English, when you want to talk about heaven and earth, you use words like heaven and earth. Heaven, earth means this, and heaven, I suppose, means that. Okay, irrelevant. In Torah, the words are eretz and shamayim. The Hebrew word eretz means running towards something. The word eretz means running towards something. And shamayim in Hebrew means kol hashamim kulam. Shamayim in Hebrew means end point destination of all the running. That's what it means. The end point destination means there's no running there. Shabbat means a sitting down because the next world is a sitting down. It's a sitting meaning that there are no legs there with which to walk. By the way, that's why angels don't have legs. Humans have legs. Angels have one leg to stand on, but they can't walk. They have no free will. They can't develop. They're always what they are. They can't walk towards themselves. Angels have wings. That's another issue. They have wings because they're sent as agents. In Hebrew, the word malach is the same as malacha. That means a create. A malach is a shlichut. It means a creative activity that he's sent to do. But humans are called mahalchim, people who walk. So here's the secret. The secret is this. The deepest secret of life is that this life is building something, which is what you will be. And when that ends, when this opportunity called life ends, what you are is what you built. Shabbat is called Me'en Olam Haba. It's a 60th, if you like, of the world to come. And therefore, every week you practice what it will feel like to die. Sounds a little weird. Shabbat is a practicing. When the sun goes down on Friday afternoon, you're frozen. If you didn't prepare it, you can't prepare it now. If you didn't cook, you don't have food. The sages say it's like taking an ocean voyage. If you don't take food with you, you don't have it out there. What you're doing every Friday afternoon, this is not a day of rest. This is not a thing called weekend. Got nothing to do with Shabbat. Shabbat is an experience that you move all week, you build a crescendo, it's a mitzvah to run on Friday afternoon. You prepare and you build the best you possibly can. It's a mitzvah to keep the very best for Shabbos. You can spend anything on Shabbat meals, you know that? You are guaranteed to be given all the money you spend on Shabbat. Whatever you want to buy, if you're very high poverty stricken you are, you can spend whatever you want on Shabbos, you're guaranteed, I'm talking about reasonable. It's got to be something that you could eat on Shabbos, or you could give your guests. You can't buy 24 crates of champagne. I mean, some people, I suppose, might intend to get through it, but I'm talking about you can spend anything you need that is legitimately a Shabbos expense, and it's completely out of the calculations, you get given it back. What?
Eden clothes? Shabbat clothes?
Yes. Nice Shabbat clothes. Not the studded leather belt that you bought in Camden or your motorcycle chain that you wear around your neck. I'm talking about that. But when you prepare, you move into Shabbos, and what's been done is what you have. And the rest of Shabbat is simply enjoying what has been prepared. Why? You are practicing what it will be like when this world ends in a Shabbos, that is the end of life. And when you get there, there's no preparing. And no message is more important than that. And therefore, it needs to be practiced and developed. So that one's whole life is building towards something that is a reality. Let's look at it this way. What's the opposite concept of the world to come? That's called Gehenna, right? Gehenna. In English, it's called hell. Which is a useless. I mean, you know, hell, the flames and the kind of thing. The concept of Gehenna means, you translate that word, it means a dimension of non-existence. Gehinnom, that means a place where nothing exists. But it doesn't mean nothing exists, it means where you don't exist. But you're around to feel it. It doesn't mean you don't exist. Not existing is fine. It's the feeling of not existing. In other words, very hard, the Kabbalistic descriptions are very hard and to put into words. But a person who's lived his whole life and not constructed any reality, so his experience in the next world is an unconstructed reality. It's a feeling of an incredible, infinite existence that should have been. the reason is that's what this person has become, or rather not become. Not a punishment, it's just what you are. To understand, the Gaon of Vilna says that this feeling of non-existence takes various forms. I'll give you one example. This is a little scary stuff, but pays now and then to scare ourselves. One version of that dimension of non-existence is called Kaf HaKela. Kaf HaKela means the cup of the slingshot. Now, you take a slingshot. Yeah, the object that you're going to sling. Yeah. What does it mean? So the Gaon of Vilna says in a famous letter that he wrote to his family that the punishment of Kaf HaKela, that means the consequence of this experience in the next world, is the experience of being slung from one place to another with a tremendous longing to arrive at that destination, but just before arriving, being slung again. And the Gaon says this is the punishment that a person goes through for wasted words. What's called dvarim betelim. Dvarim betelim. When you talk nonsense. Nonsense. I'm not talking about bad things. Lashon hara, lies, unclean language, insulting people. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about talking nonsense. What's so bad about talking nonsense? What's so bad about talking nonsense? What's bad about it is every word you utter is an emission of life energy. It is potent inner energy. Every word, when we talk about words, we don't only mean words, we mean gestures, we mean every activity, we mean everything you manifest in the world is called dibur. Dibur means taking something from inside and manifesting it on the outside. But in essence, you could talk about the words that you express. Every word that you say must have a purpose. Otherwise, you've taken a creative energy that is part of your soul. The person, the definition of the human being is a speaking being, and you've taken that and wasted it. It's as bad as wasting creative energy. And when a person does that and wastes that in the world, that's life force that should have borne seed. Hashem says about himself that every word that he utters goes to the earth and produces seed. And you have to live in his image. So every word you utter has to bear fruit in the world, has to bear seed, has to have a reason, has to have a purpose, has to do something in the world. So a person spends his life talking nonsense. The punishment for that in the next world is being flung from one place to another and never arriving. Why? What is talking nonsense? It's undertaking the journey of life but not going anywhere. Again, what is the feeling in the world of reality for a life that journeyed and never arrived? It's the feeling of a journey with a longing to arrive that never arrives. Not a punishment, it's just what you are. That's why we don't talk nonsense. As an aside, I hate to say this, but men do it much worse than women. Much worse. When women talk nonsense to each other, if you listen carefully, you'll find a lot of useful information being exchanged. When men talk nonsense, they talk total garbage. Total garbage. Men can get together and discuss sports statistics from years before for hour on end. You know that? Men can get together and spend hour after hour discussing some sport. Who kicked what or hit what? For, I mean, can you talk about garbage? And well, the mystery is why it's so delicious. Why does it feel so good to talk nonsense? This is part of a big problem of people enjoying wasting their lives. People get together to do... grown people get together to spend a few hours playing a game. Playing a game. Talk about grown, intelligent people sit around a table and they do some game that is trivial. Trivial is a compliment. Going round and round and backwards and forwards and up and down hour after hour after hour is completely inconsequential. And not only that, but it's delicious. By the way, you know why it's delicious? Because it's a little premonition of the next world in which there is no place to go. It has a little bit of the thrill of having arrived. What's unique about a game? What's unique about a game, being a pure game, not a game you do to learn something or to meet people. I'm talking about a pure game that you do to waste time. Why on earth would somebody enjoy wasting his life? You know what you could achieve in 4 hours? If you did something useful, you could achieve something that would live forever. And you spent it going round and round and round, backwards and forwards and up and down and backwards and forwards. And not only that, you enjoyed it. The reason is because you are living a little bit of Shabbos. What is Shabbat? Shabbat is a little feeling of what it feels like to have arrived in a legitimate way. Games could be legitimate too. There's a certain dose you need of those things. You need vacation. You need Shabbat. You need weekend in a legitimate dose. Spend your whole life doing destination when you haven't traveled to the destination. It's ridiculous. You need way stations. The journey needs way stations that remind you that there's a destination. Shabbat is that way station. Every week you get into a zone where everything stops and you remind yourself, this is what it's going to be like. Who am I? One of the inner work aspects of Shabbos is to feel who you've become. And hopefully like it. Most people don't, you know. Most people are so terrified of meeting the inner being that they drown their life out with noise. That if no one's chatting aimlessly to them, they've got to switch on some noise. The noise they're listening to is complete garbage, complete nonsense. It's some idiot who doesn't know what he's talking about. He's trying to convince you that he knows. He doesn't know either. But as long as there's a noise, when people are driving, they turn on a talk show. What's a talk show? It's a guy who doesn't know what he's talking about. Got no knowledge of the subject, interviewing people who know even less. So now the whole country is listening to some idiot talking about his opinion about something that he's got no knowledge about. On your way out, you buy some CDs here, Torah's Shirim CDs, and you listen to those in your car. Something useful. They intersperse the talk shows with the news, which is even bigger nonsense. And what's not nonsense, just depressing. Anyway, the point is that Shabbat is me'en olam haba. It's an exercise in knowing that the journey has a destination, and the nature of the destination is that it's what you have produced. Let's take this a little bit further. Why on Shabbos? Let's examine this. Why Shabbat built by not doing creative activity? Because when you get to the next world, there's nothing you can create. What's being created is what you are. So you get into a world where there are no tools. And therefore Shabbat is observed, built, created. That Kedusha, that sanctity in time, is built by not doing creative activity. That's how you practice what it will feel like being in a dimension where you cannot create anything. Where you simply have, you can't cook. You eat what you've cooked before. In the next world, all you will have is your own company, what you have become. The inner content you've built, the thrill of being able to live with yourself, is what will be experienced. Let's examine one or two aspects of this. Here's one. Too much to speak about. There are many, many parallels between moving from Friday into Shabbos and moving from this world to the next. Some are obvious. Many of the customs of Friday afternoon are exactly parallel to the customs of dying. For example, it's a mitzvah on Friday before Shabbos to wash, cut hair, cut nails. Right? When a person dies, we cut their hair, cut their nails, wash them. It's a mitzvah to dress in white. In some Sephardi communities, they wear a white suit on Shabbat. When a person's buried, they're dressed in a white outfit. Right? Before a person's buried, they get washed. But some communities actually put bodies in a mikveh before the person is buried. Many people go to mikveh on Erev Shabbos. Many of the things you're doing, it sounds a little weird. Sounds a little macabre. But in a positive way, what you're doing is, you're practicing moving from a dimension in which you can develop into one in which you need to be prepared. Have been prepared. Here's another parallel. One of the unique characteristics of the next world is that a person, again, this needs a lot of discussion, but just briefly in a nutshell. In the next world, a person looks like the moment they die. You know, if you think, what will I be like in the next world? It's like an average of my lifetime. It's not accurate. What a person will experience in the world to come, or the world after death, is what they were like at the last instant of life. That's good and bad. What does it mean? Imagine, for example, a person lived a negative life. Bad stuff. They did bad things. Out of control, bad things. In the last minute of life, they did tshuva. Last minute of life, they came to their senses, regretted everything, fulfilled the mitzvah of vidui and tshuva, regret, wiping out the past. That person is 100% clean. I wouldn't leave it till then. I wouldn't suggest leaving till then. But if a person did, at the last moment of life, they wiped the slate clean, the slate is clean. If you think that sounds a bit unfair, after all, Why should one person live a very good life and make a tremendous spiritual effort, and another person makes no effort, he's very bad, and the last minute they wipe the slate clean, they're equal? The answer is, they're not equal at all. All tshuva does is wipe the slate clean. It doesn't build the content of what you didn't do. Is that clear? If a person spends his whole life, right, doing mitzvahs and learning Torah and becoming a good person, every one of those mitzvahs builds a big gezunta neshama. That person's a 250-pound, muscle-bound, spiritual brute, you know, whatever the equivalent is, right? Highly developed, that person. The person who spent his whole life negative is a very thin, scrawny, rake-like individual. That person does tshuva at the end, he's completely clean. But he's a clean, scrawny, rake-like individual. Muscle on his bones, he doesn't have. Tshuva cleans the slate. It doesn't, is this clear? It doesn't. So I'm not saying they're equal. But a person could clean the slate at the last moment. But the flip side of that is, a person could lose everything in the last moment. Imagine a person who lives a good life. And the last moment, they break it down, they lose everything. I once had a teacher put it like this. He said, imagine that you have a lump of clay and you have 1 hour to make something beautiful. You have a pottery class. So you take your clay and you spend an hour making it very beautiful. Right? Let's say you spend your hour wasting time. You go to this class, you let your lump of clay sit there, you don't make any attention to the clay. Suddenly you realize that 30 seconds left before the class ends and it's all going to go into the kiln and be fired. You scramble like crazy to make something beautiful out of your clay. Whatever you make, it gets fired like that. Once it's fired, it stays like that forever. Rock hard. Not good to leave for the last moment. Hard to build something beautiful in the last moment. But let's say you built something beautiful very carefully all hour. And as it moves into the kiln, you scrunch it into a shapeless mass. That's how it gets fired. That's how it gets fired. Of course, the ideal is to work very hard all hour and guard it carefully as it goes into the kiln. That's ideal. That's the meaning of the fact that a person can do tshuva at the end of a lifetime. And they can cleanse the whole slate at the end of a lifetime. But on the other hand, you could lose it all. Here's an example. Again, this is, one shouldn't get too afraid here, only mildly terrified. Not. This is a Hasidic interpretation of a Gemara. The Gemara says that when you employ someone, how late do they have to work? Let's say you take a worker and you tell him he's going to work for you, right? And you don't agree with him what time he has to come to work and what time he goes home. You don't agree. So there are various ways to sort out that problem. But if all else fails, says the Gemara, then there's a verse in the Torah that tells you what time in the morning a worker has to come to work and what time in the evening he has to you're allowed to keep him. And the law, without going into the background, the law is that in the morning you cannot require a worker to come to work that he has to leave home before sunrise. You can't do that. Unless you agreed that with him beforehand. Or that's the norm in the place you live. But if you never stipulated, and there's no norm, you cannot make him leave home before sunrise. But you can keep him till sunset. That means, he comes to work on your time, but he goes home on his time. And the reason is because there's a verse in Tehillim that says that a person has to work, a man has to labor, v'lavidosei adei arev. A person has to work ad erev. Now, in halachic terms, ad means until. That means a person has to work until night. Night means when the sun goes down and it's evening. So he has to stay at work until the sun goes down. What question is, what does ad mean? So there's always a halachic debate about the word ad. Does until mean up until, or does until mean up until and including? If I say you have to work with me till 6 o'clock, do I mean until an instant before 6 and at 6 you're free? Do I mean you have to work until 6 and then you're free? That's called ad va'ad bichlal. That means until 6, including 6. And that's the conclusion. So it comes out like this. If the verse says that a worker has to work until nightfall, the simple meaning is that when you go and work for somebody and he pays you a wage, you've got to work until it gets dark. The deep meaning is that when he pays you a wage and you're working for him for your life, which is called daytime, when the sun goes down at the end of a lifetime, you have to work until darkness. So the Hasidic commentary said means this, that as a person dies and the lights go out, a person dies, and they move from this world into another one, there's a darkness, and then there's a light at the end of a road or a tunnel, and a whole process of moving towards that light. But before a person sees that light, there's pure darkness. That means after death, there's an instant of complete blank darkness. And in that moment, a person's own lower instinct, a person's enemy within, right? The self-destructive, what we call the Yetzer Hara, that inner energy that tries to kill you. At that moment, that energy comes to a person and says, see, I told you there's nothing here. I told you it's all a lie. What life after death? And if you accept that at that moment, you lose it all. Scrunched your clay at the last moment. The last test is a test of faith, obviously. And faith means holding strong even when it's not obvious. That's what faith is. Faith is not attaching yourself to something you can see. That's not called faith. Faith is attaching yourself to something that does not look obvious. Where do we learn this? How do you see this in Shabbos? Amazing thing. There's a law in Shabbat that the status of an object on Shabbat is what it is at the moment that the sun goes down. Example. Imagine you have, you know, on Shabbos you have a thing called muktzah, right? Muktzah, let's say like you have a pen. So a pen, thing you can't write on Shabbat. So a pen is muktzah. It's a rabbinic law that you can't move an object that's muktzah. A camera, money, various things you can't move. But let's say you have a muktzah object and it's lying on top of, let's say, a table. The table is called halachically a basis. Basis means it's a basis for the object. The law is like this. If you have a table and on top of it you have an object that it supports that's muktzah, the table's muktzah as well. So let's say you have a table and on it you have your Shabbat candles. Only your candles. Candles you cannot move on Shabbat. You can't move the table either. Why? Because the table's purpose is only to support the object that's not allowed to be moved, so you can't move the table. What happens if, late Friday night, a child or a pet knocks the candles off the table, and now it's just a table? You cannot move it tomorrow morning. The table remains muktzah. Why? Because that's what its status was when the sun went down on Friday. In other words, what defines an object's status on Shabbos is not what its previous history was. What did it look like at the moment Shabbat came in? That's when things freeze. What will you look like in the next world? The way you look when you end this journey. After all, that's where you are. If you're going on a journey, yeah, at the moment you become unable to travel any further, where are you? Where you've reached. Where you've got up to. Of course all the work up to then has brought you there. Of course it's brought you there. All the work you put into that clay makes it look beautiful. But it ends up as it ends up. There are many other parallels as well. But the basic idea is that Shabbat in every way is a practicing, if you like. The concept of rest on Shabbos, where did they get that from? Where did the non-Jewish world get the concept of rest? Because there's a truth in it. What's the truth of the rest? The journey has ended. The journey's ended. When you get to Shabbos, there's a rest in the sense that this is destination. The point about destination is that that's where you stop traveling. And therefore, the ecstasy of Shabbos, the pleasure of Shabbos, what we call the oneg, the joy of Shabbos, is the joy of having arrived. When any journey ends, when you work very hard, in the moment when you enjoy the result, it produces something very beautiful. That's why the Talmud says you'd rather have something you made yourself, that nine that you were given for free. Because you produced this. This is your work. Yep. Shabbos is the pleasure of simply having arrived. When you go over what you learned during the week, let's say your Torah material that you learned, and you labored to understand, and on Shabbat you revise it all, and you clearly feel you brought it home, and it becomes part of you. It's tremendous pleasure. Or what has become of your own life path, right? When you reach Shabbat and you can feel how different you are this week than you were the week before, that's tremendous ecstasy. Of course, when you get to Shabbos and you realize you aren't any different than the week before, that's a little bit of suffering. But every week goes by and you're not going anyplace, that's a great pity. The journey's happening and you're not going anyplace. Of course, that can be very, very, can be very depressing. Shabbat can be a very depressing time for a person who's not got a life goal and whose life is not progressing. That's the concept of Shabbos, at least an introduction to the concept. Let me add just one more word and we'll leave it at that. Just one more idea. The Gemara says that on Shabbos you get an extra soul. Extra soul. It's called neshama yetera. You get them. So first of all, the completely wrong idea is that you get two souls. You know, on Shabbos you become schizoid. Sort of like, there's two of you, you know. That's why you've got to eat extra. You've got to feed the other soul, you know. It doesn't say another soul. It says neshama yetera. You get extra soul on Shabbat. doesn't mean you get another one. It means your soul comes more into you on Shabbos. Rashi says the definition of Neshama Yosera is that you can eat more on Shabbos. Rashi says twice in the Gemara, the Neshama Yosera means you can eat more without feeling disgusted. Eat more? The day of holiness? Eat more? What's going on? I would have thought you eat less. The definition of Neshama Yosera, again, we need to discuss it in much more detail. And we have, in fact, in the past, gone into detail. But the idea of Neshama Yosera is, Neshama always means the higher aspect of soul. The Nefesh is the lower aspect. The Nefesh is the aspect that's in the body. The Neshama is the part that's above the body. The very, very holy part. Elokai Neshama Shenasata B'Tahiri. Hashem, the Neshama that you gave me is pure. No matter how bad you are, you can always say that the Neshama is pure. It's outside the head, hovers around the head, right? It's much higher than the person. On Shabbat, that comes into the body more. Right? You know, it's very interesting. The Neshama Yosera is called Neshama Yetera. More Neshama. Right? We learn it from a verse in the Torah that says, Vayinafash. Vayinafash. And he rested. So there, the Mefarshim say, Vay Avda Nefesh. Vayinafash. Vay Avda Nefesh. When Shabbat goes out, the soul, this aspect of higher soul leaves, and it's a terrible suffering. That's how we smell spices. When you smell spices on Shabbat, Motzei Shabbat, you are reviving the soul that feels very weak because the higher aspect of soul has gone. So one of the mysteries is this. Why, if the Torah calls it nefesh, do we call it neshama? The Torah calls it vayinafash, nefesh, that's the lower soul. And we call it neshama yetera, the higher soul. The answer is this. On Shabbat, the higher soul, the spiritual soul, the pure soul, the perfect soul, the one that is transcending the human being, comes more into the body. Nefesh, the animal nefesh, becomes more elevated, becomes more, receives more of the neshama. Normally, you should not eat too much. Why? Because when you eat too much, you become more earthy, more material. If you overeat sufficiently, you become completely mindless. On Shabbos, you can eat more. The body, the lower aspect of soul, the nefesh aspect of the human being, the animal aspect of the human being, is more invested with Kedusha on Shabbos. On Shabbat, it's paradoxical, but uniquely Jewish. What's unique about Judaism, we've said this many times, is that in Jewish thinking, the body can be elevated. In non-Jewish thinking, to become holy, the body must be left behind. A universal concept in non-Jewish spirituality is that the body is too dangerous to engage. You want to be holy, become a monk or a nun, meditate on a mountaintop, wear a sack, don't go near women or wine. That's earthy stuff. When you get involved in the sensual, it will bring you down. Universally in the Far East, in Christianity, Christianity is fraught with guilt and tension and conflict about sensuality. If you're serious about being a holy Christian, you have to become a monk or a nun. Muslims may not own alcohol. A Muslim, never mind drink, they're not allowed to own alcohol. Alcohol, very dangerous, brings you down into the physical world. And in Judaism, you have to get married. You sin if you don't get married. You have to drink wine. You're considered a sinner if you avoid wine. The Jewish concept is that you have to get the soul into the body and use it to lift the body. The non-Jewish concept is you get the soul into the body, it'll bring the soul down. They're right, it's very dangerous. But what's unique about Torah is that it's the exercise of putting the soul into the body to elevate the body. It's very dangerous. On Shabbos, you can eat more. On Shabbat, the more soul goes into body, the more body can be elevated. What's unique about Neshama Yosera, says Rashi, is you can eat more. Meaning, during the week, if you eat too much, dangerous. Shabbat is less dangerous. On Shabbat, you can eat more, and it will be more of a spiritual experience. That's why you notice, maybe we'll finish with this, in Judaism, we always take wine, which is very dangerous. Wine, extremely dangerous. Alcohol, very dangerous. Alcohol, if taken in immodest measure, banishes the soul entirely. You have enough alcohol, you become part of the scenery. Very dangerous. And we take alcohol, we take wine, at every moment of engaging the physical. Whenever the physical meets the spiritual, you know, as Jews, we're so used to it, we don't even notice. Two people are getting married, there's a cup of wine. What has the wine got to do with marriage? Shabbat's coming in, you take a cup of wine. A baby's being circumcised. What does a bris have to do with a cup of wine? The secret is, wine is a substance that is very dangerously going to link you into the physical, but used correctly can open consciousness. The Gemara says, Nichnas yayin yatzasod. When wine goes in, the secret is revealed. It doesn't only mean you start talking about your secrets. It means the inner world becomes revealed. Yayin in Hebrew is 70, sod is 70. Right? Exactly because it's dangerous enough to bring you completely into the physical is why it can elevate you as much as it can elevate you. The Gaon of Vilna says, wine is the only substance known that obeys the laws of the spiritual, not the physical. Physical things always get worse with time. All physical things get worse with time. The body, machines, everything gets worse with time. Spiritual things get better with time, like wisdom and judgment. Wine is a physical substance that gets better with time. It's an unusual... So the Gaon says, that gives you an... It's a physical substance that gives you an insight, a connection with the spiritual world. And every time we are doing the very dangerous work, two people are getting married. That could be what's called kiddushin, sanctification, or a very sordid animal physical relationship. We take a cup of wine. Bris milah, circumcision. You're taking the aspect of the human existence, which is most given to being fallen an animal, and you're giving it the sign of kedusha, sanctity. We take a cup of wine. Shabbat. When the weekday, that mundane, ordinary physicality of the week, connects with Shabbat, which is the higher world, we take a cup of wine. We are always joining the two, right? With that substance, which... What's Havdalah? Maybe we'll finish with this. What's Havdalah? The Shabbos, the week goes out, and you drop into the week, and you take a cup of wine. That's exactly the point. The whole point of leaving Shabbat behind is to come down into a week of work, so that you can spiral back to Shabbat the next week higher than you were the one before. Shabbos isn't, the week isn't a cycle that you hit Shabbos, it's elevated, you go down into the week. You hit Shabbos, elevated, that's not the point. The week is supposed to be a circle, Shabbat's supposed to be higher than the week before, and then you come down to work to get higher next week. It's a spiral. Yes, you pass the same starting point each week called Shabbos, but each one higher than the week before. When you come out of Shabbat, you take a cup of wine because ultimately that's the greatest elevation. The Kabbalists call it a Yerida Tzorech Aliyah. It's a going down for the sake of a going up. You're not in this world to experience the next world. This is not a constant Shabbos. You're in this world to work to build a Shabbat that is a consolidation of what you built. You know, the Torah never mentions Shabbat without mentioning 6 days of work first. Check it out. Every time the Torah talks about Shabbos, it says, 6 days shall you work and experience Shabbos. Sheishis yamim tav, work six. Why? Shabbos is only meaningful after you work for 6 days. If you lie, you know, semi-comatose 7 days of the week, Shabbos isn't Shabbos. Destination is destination after your journey to get there. And therefore, Shabbos is only the result of 6 days of work. And therefore, after you've experienced that incredible reminder of what the next world is and means, you take a cup, you come down into the week, I must say Shabbos, you take a cup of wine. You're connecting that Kedusha of the previous Shabbos into this week that's going to be an effort of development to get you next Shabbos closer to that final destination. Okay, we'll stop there.